Last week we spent time looking at the fact that the Isaiah 58 is written to a people who are seeking after God and who want God, and he wants them. So the initial relationship is one with that is positive. At the heart of this are people who are seeking a God who's seeking them. And we talked a little bit about finding joy in the Lord, that's the ultimate purpose of this chapter, is to find joy. And that our mission statement at the well, which is up here, fostering friendships, practicing compassion, growing Christ followers, and even the whole of Isaiah 58 is ultimately about that. Growing as Christ followers, adding them to the world in and through and because we practice compassion and we foster friendships. So the things that the people that Isaiah 58 is written to, they weren't happening. They wanted some good things and those things weren't happening. Mostly they wanted justice for themselves. They wanted a just society and they didn't see it around them. And God said that's because they weren't being the kind of people who could receive it. And that's why they weren't getting it. Again, this isn't to do with salvation. This isn't about whether or not they are a saved people. It's about whether or not they are receiving the kind of justice and living the kind of just society that they want. So worship is what we're going to be talking about this week. And I think it's kind of incomprehensible and mysterious sometimes what we're talking about when we talk about the word worship. In the Christian tradition, worship has often centered around and church structures have been organized around a specific language. So from the early church, when we have churches that split off from each other, a lot of those centered around having a common language. We use it kind of a liturgical language, meaning that's the language scripture is read in and the prayers are prayed in. And when you come to church, this is the language that you hear. And that's how churches were structured traditionally up until about the 19th century. Like you would pick a church and you would go to a church because the sacred language that happened was the language you saw as sacred. Again, there's long histories of using a specific translation of the Bible or a specific language for worship. And so for many people throughout history, the sound and experience of worship is connected to hearing prayers in a specific language, specific cadences that are not connected to everyday life. They're kind of sacred languages. They sound a bit holier. You may be too young here to be used to going to a worship service where you'd hear a lot of these and thous in prayer. But that was a thing in the English language. Many English language churches used a particular form, an old form of English. That was the sacred form that when you went to church, this is how you talk to God. This is how you hear the sacred texts. That's a very traditional sort of thing. Today I've asked some of our wellies to read Isaiah 58 in a language that they know. And it could be a language they're born speaking or one that they learned, but it's a language of worship to some Christian somewhere in the world. And they're going to share that. So what I'd like for you to do is kind of sit back and listen. You don't need to read along, but just sit back and let the language of the sacred text kind of wash over you. And part of the idea of having a sacred language is that you're not spending lots of time analyzing what all the words mean. You're just kind of engaged in what the flow of that sacred text is. And it makes you kind of feel and adapt and adopt certain kind of postures and phrases. For many of you, you may have had experiences like that. You know what I mean. But just appreciate this aesthetically. We read it in English last week. We'll read it again in July and August. You'll be looking at it potentially in English today. But let's have the five people who I asked come forward. And they're going to introduce themselves and the language they're reading in. But they're just going to go from verses 1 through 14. So we'll start with Bridget over here and Chelsea is over here. The guy's in the middle. I'm going to step back here. You'll start with it. And I think it's Anton next and then Lloyd and Philip.
Hello, my name is Bridget. and I'm going to be reading in French. Does anyone here speak French? Good. Okay. It's my second language, so. Okay. Le Seigneur dit, crie à plein voix, ne te retiens pas. Fais résonner ta voix comme une trompette. Présente ses fautes à mon peuple, leurs péchés aux fautes de Jacob. Tous les jours, ils me consultent, ils veulent savoir ce que je t'en donne. Ils ressemblent à un peuple qui respecte la justice et qui n'abandonne pas la loi de son Dieu. Ils me demandaient des jugements justes. Ils veulent que je sois proche d'eux. Pourtant, ils me disent, « Pourquoi jeûner si tu ne le vois pas? Pourquoi nous faire petites si tu ne le remarquais pas? » Alors je réponds, « Le jour où vous jeûnez, vous vous occupez aussi de vos affaires. » Et vos agissez dormant avec vos ouvriers.
Good morning. My name is Anton. I'm going to read it in the language that's not as pretty, Russian. So, вот вы поститесь для ссор и распри, для того, чтобы дерзкой рукой убить других. Вы не поститесь в это время так, чтобы голос ваш был услышан на высоте. Таков ли тот пост, который я избрал, день, в который томит человек душу свою? Когда гнет голову свою, как тростник, и постилает под себя рубящий пепел. Это ли назовешь постом и днем, угодным Господу? Вот пост, который я избрал, разреши оковы неправды, развяжи узы ярма, угнетенных отпусти на свободу, и расторгни всякое ярмо. Раздели с голодным хлеб свой, и скитающихся бедных введи в свой дом. Когда увидишь нагого, одень его, и от единокровного своего не укрывайся. Тогда откроется, как заря, твой свет, и исцеление твое скоро возрастет, и правда твоя пойдет перед тобой, и слава Господня будет сопровождать тебя.
I'm Lloyd, and I'm going to be speaking in a language called Shoshone. It's from a region, it's from the country of Zimbabwe, southern region of Africa. Ipapo uchadana Jehova, achakupindura uchad Uchadani zira, ucha rubat zira, uye achati ndi pano. Kana ucha bitsa joko kudengita ta no umwe, no kutara kwaka ipa, uye ukapa zwako kune wanenzara. Uye uku guta pakoshaye kwabo, ipapo chie za chako, chichabuda murima. Uye usiku kwako ukajakuduka ukafanana namaskadi.
Good morning. My name is Philip, and I'll be reading in Serbian, which is a South Slavic language somewhat related to Russian. Jer će te Gospod voditi vazda i siti će dušu tvoju na suši, i kosti tvoje krepiće i bit ćeš kao vrt zaliven i kao izvor kojemu vode ne presiše. I tvoji će sazirati stare pustoline i podignut ćeš temelje koji će stajati od koljena do koljena i prozaćeš se koji sazide razvaline i opravi putove za naselje.
Good morning, my name is Chelsea and I get to read in Spanish, which I'm sure many of you already know, so bear with my accent. Si dejas de profanar el sábado y no haces negocios en mi día santo, si llamas al sábado delicia y al día santo del Señor honorable. Si te abstienes de profanarlo y lo honras, no haciendo negocios ni profiriendo palabras inútiles, entonces hallarás tu gozo en el Señor. Sobre las cumbres de la tierra te haré cabalgar y te haré que te deleites en la herencia de tu padre Jacob. El Señor mismo lo ha dicho.
Let's give them a hand. Thank you. Thanks, folks. My favorite Spanish word is entonces. Such a useful word. So glad it was in that passage. Thank you so much. I am curious, how many of you here do have another language you can read or speak? Yeah, okay, that's great, besides English. Like hearing that. So today we're delving into how a people who might want to know and reflect God, how they wanted to worship, and how God is responding to that, why he wants them to worship in another way, and how that worship should look. So if you do have a passage in whatever language you might be using, we're going to look at a few of the verses on worship in Isaiah 58, starting with verse 3, when he says that the people that he's talking to, the Israelites who've just returned from Babylon, and he's talking to the ones that are in Jerusalem, he's talking to the ones that are still in Babylon, and some of the commentators say that there's also a Persian audience here, that he's talking to a whole bunch of the people that are in exile with and the ones beyond. Why have we fasted and you've not seen? Why have we humbled ourselves and you have not noticed? And God says to them in that same verse, in verse 3, on the day of your fasting, you do as you please and exploit all your workers. In verse 4, God criticizes them because he says, your fasting ends in quarreling and strife. You cannot fast as you do today and expect your voice to be heard on high. So this kind of fasting isn't the kind of worship that connects us with the transcendent, with the divine. Verse 5, he says that the wrong kind of fasting is a fasting that focuses on yourself, a kind of worship that's self-centered. In verse 6, of course, we're going to come back to these in July, many of these verses, these passages we spent some time with last week as well. Basically, God's kind of fasting and worship is focused on fixing injustice, or at least not fixing it, but working at it, trying to change it up, trying to do something to undermine injustice. And finally, in verse 13, he says that good worship calls the Sabbath a delight, and we honor the Sabbath and honor true worship by not doing just as we please or speaking idle words or going our own way. Verses 14 and 11, maybe that's the wrong order, we like to do them numerically, 11 and 14, I think demonstrate the point of worship, one of which is the last verse in that chapter, verse 14, is the joy of the Lord. The whole point of any kind of worship is to experience joy in the Lord. And in verse 11, part of the point is God's guidance, satisfying our needs and allowing us to be able to go out and serve others. So the point of worship is that it empowers us both to care for our own needs, quiet our own souls, find our own joy, and then to go out and serve others. So those are the passages we're just going to be spending a little time teasing apart. And this brings us back to the assumption that I made in reading this, and that's that fasting is a part of worship or is an element of worship. And so I wanted to think about that a little bit because I realized when I was reading it, I had that assumption. And what's very clear is that the people in the audience for this chapter, they thought there was a quid pro quo going on. So we fast and you do this. They also don't seem to understand the collective nature of their worship, that it's not about individual fasting, but it's about what's happening collectively. Fasting obviously can be done as part of worship, but it obviously doesn't have to be. So we're going to be trying to look a little bit at fasting as a part of worship. There are two kinds of fasting in the culture that this chapter was written in. One kind was intended to heighten their personal spiritual experience. So you would fast and pray. That's kind of the phrase that it had. So the idea was that fasting could heighten, and this is true in lots of religious expressions around the world, that people for a very long time in many places have noticed that self-restraint, especially with regards to food and sometimes other things, can help heighten a spiritual experience. So that was one kind of fasting. But the other kind of fasting that I found a slightly more interesting in some ways is the idea of fasting as lament. So the first kind of fasting is often deeply personal. It's about associated with things like mysticism. It means something like if you decide to do some guided meditation or mindfulness or go on a yoga retreat or something, as opposed to the second kind, which sometimes is much more collective and is about lament. It's about public acknowledgement of a problem. And it often goes along with sackcloth and ashes in this culture. A public acknowledgement that something is wrong. And it's that kind of fasting that is also being talked about in this passage. It's personal and collective. So one of the kinds of fasts, that kind of fast in today's world might be when we boycott something collectively. We say we're all going to go without something in order to draw attention to an issue or to help right a wrong, perhaps. Sometimes we might choose to come together, spend a day learning about or sitting with an injustice. So we might choose to take a day, and instead of doing what we feel like doing, we're going to listen to people who have experienced or who are victims of a problem and injustice and receive some education about it, and also sit with that tragedy, sit with that problem. We might sometimes march in order to mourn collectively, kind of out in the streets. But fasting is more about lament than about advocacy. So we're going to talk about things like advocacy later on in the summer in this series. We talk about Isaiah 58. But I want to think a little bit about lament. Like, we might bring in our friends and loved ones and neighbors who are Native Americans, who are suffering from long-term challenges, and sit quietly with them, with the victims of a natural disaster, let's say. Listen to their challenges, their problems, their stories, not with the ability to fix it right away, but with the desire to sorrow with them or listen to or celebrate with them. This sort of fasting is less active. It's less productive. It's a different kind of fasting. One of my friends years ago, someone I worked with, decided to fast from anything that was not water. And he did this publicly. He said, I'm not going to drink juice or soda or coffee or tea. And I'm going to spend the money that I regularly spend on that. I'm going to donate that to a cause about bringing water to people who don't have it. And he invited other people to join him. But during the year that he chose to do that, he also spent a lot of time educating himself on these issues and also choosing to educate other people, anyone that would listen around him or who wanted to hear about it. So it wasn't only about changing something. It was also about sitting with and participating with a sort of fast, a sort of lament for the fact that there are people who don't have access to a basic human need, which is water that's drinkable. Part of what the people in this chapter in Isaiah 58 are upset about is that they have actually shown real lament, they feel like, and yet nothing changed. We've sorrowed, we've fasted, and nothing has changed. And part of what I want to mention is that we're going to end this series talking about the new earth, the new heaven and the new earth. And we're going to see where God is actually taking us, where he's trying to get us to. But part of our humanness is that we're impatient and we want things to change right now. You know, the joke that, like, I spent 15 minutes working out and I'm shocked that I haven't lost 5 pounds, you know, that day. Like, clearly, I extended myself. We should have that change happen right now. Like, we're impatient. We want there to be change. And yet, we're called to lament and to sit with a fasting and lament without holding God hostage for what actually happens. That's part of what Isaiah 58 says. To confess and to say we're sorry and that we need him, but to know that often what our ideals are of what should change aren't necessarily going to change right away, aren't what occur. So let's broaden the acts of worship from fasting to kind of a wider scope here and what actually is worship, according to this chapter and other Bible passages. According to Webster's Dictionary, which of course I looked up what the definition of worship is, it's entering into an expression or feeling of reverence or adoration for a deity. Now, worship does not, for most humans and most of history, involve a change in emotions always. But it does involve an expression, an activity that you enter into, mostly with your whole body. And it does involve something greater than you, a god, a spirit, something that is greater than you, which you are submitting yourself to in some way. That's part of what adoration means. That's part of what worship means. So those are kind of three different elements. There's sometimes emotions, but most oftenly it's actions that posture us. And we're talking about something other, something above. Worship also, I think, ultimately involves honesty about who we are and who God is. So it's our acknowledgement of who I am, the adored child of God. That is fundamentally who you are. The adorable child of God. That's your identity over under his identity as the creator, sustainer, lover of you and everybody else. Again, that's why we sing songs that might say things that we don't actually always believe at the time. Because worship involves us deciding to orient ourselves to who we actually are. I might not always believe it intellectually. Worship allows me to enter into it with my body, with my presence, with my voice, with my quietness, with my encouragement alongside other people, into who I actually am and who God actually is. So we practice it. We practice worship. And we come together and we sing and we say and we listen to things that remind us of where and who we are. Being honest, basically, that the most important things in this world, the things that the world values, material wealth, maintaining our house, building up my ego, proving myself to others, that those things are not actually the most important things. They're not fundamental to who I am. So we need reminders of that. When we worship, we come out of those things. We say we're not going to be striving to prove ourselves. We're not going to be building up material wealth. We're taking time aside to reorient ourselves. Instead, I'm allowing myself to see myself honestly and God honestly by being attentive to who is greater than me. Attentiveness is at the heart of worship. Attentiveness to God and to myself. Historians like to say that we study the past so that we won't be so egocentric about ourselves in the present. Right, we only know what's around us, what we've experienced in our lives. I was in Australia and I was at a kid's soccer game and there was a big hailstorm, like more hail than I've ever experienced. It's sort of a normal thing there. Although a 9-year-old informed me that they've never seen hail like that before. She was like, this is the most hail I've ever seen in my whole life, you know. And, you know, you're a little older, you're like, oh, that may or may not be a big statement about whether or not it's a big hailstorm, right? That's part of what history does. It helps us not think that this is the only voice that matters, that these are the only smart people. It helps us think about our context. My world is very limited if I only know about the here and now. Worship allows me to acknowledge those limits, be honest about them, but also to widen my mind and perspective a little bit so that I can receive from God and I can allow the transcendent to come in, to expand me. I've heard a pastor talk once about something I think he'd read about, so maybe other people have. I haven't read about it. I don't know who to cite for this, which is a very upsetting situation to be in as an academic, but that's the chain of information. That's all you get. That there are kind of 5 ways that people have of experiencing God. I don't know if it's like the 5 love languages. I'm sure it's just generic and arbitrary. But that some of those involve study. Some people come to God through study, Bible study, other kinds of study. Some people it's music. Some people it's nature. Some people it's quiet prayer and meditation, solitude. And some people it's kind of action, service, that's how they experience God. Now, I think we all need, actually, all of those things. But it's also good to be honest about how and where it is that we come in contact with the transcendent and the divine. How does God touch us? In what context does that happen? We need all of them, but some of them are going to link us to God better. The other element of worship that I want to just say something about that I find super challenging, and that's that worship involves the sacred. I think I've said this here before, but I have a really hard time knowing what is sacred, what that means, how we experience it. Do I feel that anything is sacred? And I'm pretty sure that's because I'm a modern human being. And this is, again, something as somebody who studies pre-modern history is the thing that I and my students have the most challenge with is taking seriously the fact that people in the past experienced and understood things to be sacred. Modern's like nothing is sacred to us. We understand it. Knowledge puffs us up, and I know now how lightning works and thunder and natural elements that people used to think of as sacred in the God speaking. So I'm not afraid of it. I have power over it. I surmount it. We climb mountains. We don't just sit in awe of their sacredness. As tourists, we tromp all over the sacred sites of other people and other cultures for whom those people would never have gone into those. There were only certain people. I mean, imagine if you have, you know, stories that you grew up with the temple or the tabernacle in the wilderness, and imagine people touring through that on a regular basis. When people only went into the most holy place every, like, a couple times a year, once a year, whatever. My biblical literacy is failing me. But we as tourists, we want to go see that Ark of the Covenant, take our pictures with it. This is what we do as moderns. Nothing is sacred. Now, in the tradition that this church is in, we practice sacredness in time. I don't actually know what that means. But I think that the fact that we have Sabbath and why Sabbath is included in this worship is that it is a chance to practice sacredness. Not in space, and this particular congregation that we have not talked about this space as sacred, right? We do all sorts of things in this space. Now, I think when the Holy Spirit is present anywhere, it's sacred. But that's also me being very democratic and modern, and it means that sacredness means nothing, really. If everything is sacred, nothing is sacred. And that is kind of true. Now, I do believe everything is sacred, but I also think unless you kind of have a sense of what sacredness is, saying that doesn't make it mean anything. Another human being isn't sacred if I have no notion of what sacredness is. So for us, sacredness in time is a chance to kind of practice what sacred means. These hours are sacred. What does that mean? How do we practice that? How do we acknowledge that? Now, again, it's fascinating here that Sabbathing is brought in. I think worship is intended to have us stop all of our normal human ego need-based activities and orient ourselves differently. And I think that's what Sabbath allows us to do. We get to orient ourselves differently during this time. Sabbathing, fasting, praying, studying, these are all worshiping. Sabbathing is part of that. And if you acknowledge like the whole of the Sabbath is sacred, not just the time that we spend here in worship, that it's time, not space, that's sacred, this can help us think about what our practice of sacredness is. Again, what happens during this time we choose to acknowledge as worship. I think that's one of the things that happens. If everything I do during Sabbath, from this afternoon where I promised to take my nieces to the swimming pool, to what we do for Sabbath morning for breakfast, all of that is an act of worship and is sacred because it involves sacred time, it can make me think differently about that when I acknowledge that. Sabbathing can help us support each other in this because we do it together. We're collectively Sabbathing. Because there is objective holiness to this time. It's not holy because I make it holy with what I do. It just is. Again, thinking about time being holy just blows my mind a little bit. I'm saying things to myself here because I don't actually know how to do that or what it means. And the Sabbath is both a feast and a fast. Both of those things. The way fasting from work on vacation allows us to feast. And vice versa. Feasting at work helps it be a little bit like a vacation. Sabbathing is a retreat away from the needs of this world. It's a boundary. And it's also an indulgence in what we know feeds our soul the most. It's a practice of trusting God to provide rather than just my own works. Now, those of us that grew up in a tradition that was very legalistic about Sabbath keeping, we can kind of bristle a little bit at what boundaries might look like. And I'm not at all intending for that to be kind of the tone of this conversation, although I do think that if we don't sort of think about what we choose to indulge in and what we don't, we miss out. Just like if you never actually vacation away from your work, if you never stop working, you aren't actually getting a vacation. There are sort of boundaries on that, and it's going to look different for all of us. So, our worship is a paradox. It calls us to stop and be quiet and still ourselves before the Creator. But it also involves transferring ourselves into filling up in worship time so that we can go out and serve others. So we're intended to be unselfish about our worship. So those of us that need our mindfulness and our quiet time, if it turns out that it's just all about me filling myself up because I need my Sabbath naps, I need my rest, I need my Zen time, and that never transitions into me thinking about the person who can't get out of their house to worship with other people on Sabbath and who might need some extra help getting there, the parents who, for crying out loud, could just use a nap occasionally, but that's not what Sabbath looks like for them, and they might need some extra help. If it never transitions out into justice and service in the world, then it's not actually worship, God says. So we have a paradoxical loop that goes on where I transition into worship and quiet myself before God so that I can go out in activity for others. And if that activity happens too often without that refreshment, it becomes a burnout zone. And if all I do is indulge in myself, I become, you know, sort of a legend in my own time. I'm never actually listening to what God might tell me about who around me needs something. Again, we don't solve all the problems in the world. We can't. We're not trying to go out there and fix everything. But we do have some things here at the well through our own work that come out of our acts of worship that can allow us to do that. And today I wanted to ask our the head of our outreach team, Melissa Moore, to come up and talk to us a little bit about something that we might lament about, and then potentially through prayer and quietness find ways, maybe if this is what God's calling you to, that we can do something about.
Is this thing? Okay, awesome. So I just wanted to share a few things. Probably most of you have seen a lot of really terrible, awful, heart-wrenching pictures and videos about what's been happening in our detention centers, what's been happening with refugees around the world. And so I just wanted to offer a few facts and some summary. By no stretch am I an expert in this area, so just wanted to put that disclaimer out there. But before I get into these slides, I just wanted to read for you a few definitions that often get misused. And so, first of all, does everyone know, maybe I don't need to share this, does everyone know the difference between an immigrant, a refugee, and an asylum seeker? Does anyone feel like they know the answers to that question with confidence? I did not. So I'm just going to read it. This is the definition of an immigrant. This is from the United Nations. An immigrant is someone who makes a conscious decision to leave his or her home and move to a foreign country with the intention of settling there. So my dad did that in the 80s, came from the Philippines to Chicago and was an immigrant, came here. He could have gone back if he wanted to. He was not scared of his home country. He just wanted to come to the United States. So that is an immigrant. Then we have an asylum seeker. An asylum seeker is someone who is also seeking international protection from dangers in his or her home country, but whose claim for refugee status has not been legally determined. So they're wanting to be a refugee legally, but they are in the process. They are still seeking asylum. A refugee is someone who has been forced to flee his or her home because of war, violence, or persecution, often without warning. They are unable to return home unless and until conditions in their native lands are safe for them again. So, we hear a lot about the refugees coming from Central and South America, from Mexico. But would you guess where the top country where we had the most refugees coming from to the United States in the fiscal year of 2018? What country? Interactive. Shout it out. Syria. No. Syria did not make it to the top 10 list. Burma is second, with 3,500-ish refugees from Burma. The number one country with 7,800 refugees, Democratic Republic of Congo. So I didn't know that. By the end of 2018, 70.8 million people have been displaced around the world, forcibly displaced around the world. These are not the people like my dad who just chose to come to the United States. And so what is the United States doing about this? Every year, the United States decides a set number of refugees that they will allow into this country. So how many people were forcibly displaced last year? 70 million. How many refugees are we going to allow into this country during this fiscal year 2019? Just a wild guess. 50,000. Close. 30,000. 30,000. So I just want to give you some background. This is why we are, or I guess a contributing factor as to why we're having such overcrowding in our detention centers, is because we have so many millions of people seeking refuge, and we have limited the number of people. I was really trying to show you all a video, like, that would explain this better than me, but it was, like, super political and super, like, attacking a specific political party. I was like, maybe I'm just going to avoid that part and just read to you the excerpts of facts. So I just wanted to go through some pictures and some facts specifically about our detention centers. And so I would like to kind of cast that in the umbrella of the least of these verse. And so we can go through here. I'm going to read this to you, this part here in Matthew 25 that probably many of us are familiar with, where it says, Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you something to drink? When did we see you a stranger and invite you in, or needing clothes and clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison and go visit you? The king will reply, truly I tell you, whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers and sisters of mine, you did for me. All right, so hungry and thirsty. I'm breaking up this verse and sharing with you quotes specifically that are from people that are currently being detained at these detention centers. So this young boy says, I'm hungry here at the Clint Detention Center all the time. I'm so hungry that I have woken up in the middle of the night with hunger. Sometimes I wake up from hunger at 4 a.m., sometimes at other hours. I'm too scared to ask the officials here for any more food, even though there is not enough food here for me. That's a 12-year-old boy. Strangers. So we have all of these people who are strangers outside the gate. Next one. Okay, so the verse talks about, when did I see you needing clothes? So this one really hit me because I've got, like, this really beautiful little boy back there. Okay, so this is a 17-year-old mother. She says, 3 days ago, my baby soiled his clothes. I had no place to wash the clothes, so I could not put them back on my baby. Since then, my baby of only 3 months has only been wearing a small little jacket made of T-shirt material. I have nothing else for my son to wear. I've been told they do not have any clothes here at this place. I just want my baby to be warm enough. I'm having to make sure I carry my baby super close to me to keep his little body warm. Sick. I was apprehended with my father. The immigration agent separated me from my father right away. I was very frightened and scared. I cried. I have not seen my father again. I've had a cold and a cough for several days, and I have not seen a doctor. I have not been given any medicine. This is a 5-year-old boy in prison. Does that look like, I mean, that looks like prison to me. There's gates and tons of people all crowded together. So I don't want us to just say, wow, that's really awful. I'd really love for, me included, I'd like to be more involved. I know it's super easy when I get on my phone and there's like these really awful pictures and videos and I'm like, scroll, scroll, scroll. Oh, look, a puppy. Yay, happy. Scroll, scroll. Oh, I don't want to read that. But I do think that we have a biblical mandate to care about these people. So what can you do? First, I think just be informed. And it's really hard, I believe, to be empathetic when you're not informed. So start with being informed, then be empathetic. Be an advocate, take action. And so I'm going to share just three. There are so many options, and maybe you know of something even more tangible. But the first one I wanted to share was, this is through the United Nations human rights website. Oh, UNICEF. Sorry. This is through UNICEF. So this is specifically about child and refugee immigrants. And so there's that red button on the website where you can donate. Sure. I went to the bluish, greenish button here on the right that said, tell Congress. I'm not super political. I feel like I should be more informed and be more active. But it's so great that we do in this country have a voice. And so I went there and I clicked on this link and there was already like a pre-made letter. You can just do that. I added a bunch of like, this is why I'm so mad about this and this is why I think you should do something about this. But you can just literally click there. You put in your zip code and it already like knows who your representatives are. So it was really easy. I also then like signed up for alerts, for text alerts or email alerts. Like I want to be informed specifically about child refugees and migrants. So that's one way is to be informed like about what's happening nationally. And then there are two organizations here in Chattanooga that I wanted to highlight. The first is Bridge Refugee Services, and this is their mission statement here. It says, we are a nonprofit agency. They are here and in Knoxville as well. They're committed to providing protection and assistance in refugees' inspiring journey. We recognize their plight, their resilience, and their willingness to join our community and make it their own. Become part of America's proud tradition of welcoming refugees and come join us as we work together, building lives in a new land. Their website is there, bridgerefugees.org. And they have on their website a list of ways specifically that you could volunteer. So that's next up. Oh, man, that's really hard to read. Okay. You should go to bridgerefugees.org. But the first one, so there are two basic categories. One is pre-arrival and one's post-arrival. So basically, before they come, sometimes Bridge just gets like a notice like someone's coming, like they're flying tomorrow, and then they've got to set up an apartment for them, supply their kids with some school supplies often, help them get groceries, help them to move in. So that's all before they get there. And then when the families move in, sometimes they just need help with transportation, getting around. I happen to lead mission trips for a living, and so I know how scary it can be when you get into a country that you don't know the language and you can't read the signs, and I can't imagine coming from a traumatic situation to a new country. I just come because it's really fun to go and serve other people in new places. But they need help with interpretation. Man, we had 5 different languages represented here today. I think how many more of you might also be able to kind of help with some interpretation. My Spanish is like un poquito, but I feel like I could probably help a little bit. Even if you don't speak another language, maybe volunteer so that somebody can help practice their English with you and help them to just get around and get to know their community. So those are some areas specifically with Bridge Refugee Services. The second organization I wanted to share with you in this area specifically is AMFA, which is the Adventist Muslim Friendship Association. You've heard Lindsay share about them. I know Matt Ansel has volunteered with them. Several of you, I think. Who has volunteered in some way with AMFA? Okay, the Mobutos, the Weavers. We did a little bit in our small group. So what's really interesting and what's really great about this opportunity is that this is specifically Adventists reaching out to Muslims in this area. So we are a network of Adventists in North America driven by the love of Jesus who desire to bless the refugee community and help them integrate in a godly way. And there's their website down there. It's amfa4refugees.com. And basically, like, their volunteer list looked almost identical to the Bridge Refugees list. But if you're specifically wanting to serve as an Adventist reaching Muslims, this is another organization I would recommend for you. I know that they've come to Southern before to look for volunteers, and I'll just warn you, they're not really interested in you want to volunteer this one time for this one thing. They'd really love for you to be really invested. I know they've asked our students to like attend a very significant training and be willing to like to really partner with these families so that they are able to create a bond with you. I know, Lindsay, is summer camp over? Okay. So they had a summer camp for the children. I don't know if you heard Lindsay's announcement a couple weeks ago, earlier this month. And that's something that's, even though they don't have a formal summer camp, I'm sure if you wanted to volunteer and help with the children that are getting ready to go to school, there's just so many different ways. So I'd love, if you are interested in specifically working with refugees, please come find me after this service. But I just wanted to highlight, so just to recap those 3 things. UNICEF website. You can get information about what's happening nationally, Bridge Refugee Services, and also through AMFA. So thank you. Appreciate that.
Again, we want there to be something we can do about things sometimes. And I'm going to have us park that for a second and now engage in a little bit of worship. Because we worship in our bodies. It's not primarily with our minds. What we do in our bodies is intended to help us and experience a reality that's in our hearts and minds. So we act in ways that help us shape our hearts and minds. And again, part of that spiritual rest that we need for our minds happens when we just stop and breathe. And some people call this mindfulness. There's also things like guided breathing, guided meditation. These are old Christian practices. So we're going to do a little bit of that for a second here. Everybody's okay being a little weird. Should I just tuck away your digital devices? We're going to take a full 3 minutes. And we're going to be quiet. Now, there are those among us who are not going to be quiet, and there are going to be noises that we hear, and that's all right. I'm just going to let those kind of wash over us. It's not going to be silent, but we're just going to be still in our bodies, be aware of ourself, our humanness in the bodies God created as beloved children of God. We're going to just be still and know that He is God. Mary Oliver writes a poem that embodies elements of worship for me. You do not have to be good. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert repenting. You have only to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. Tell me about despair, yours, and I will tell you mine. Meanwhile, the world goes on. Meanwhile, the sun and the clear pebbles of the rain are moving across the landscapes over the prairies and the deep trees, the mountains and the rivers. Meanwhile, the high geese, wild in the clean blue air, are heading home again. Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination, calls you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, over and over, announcing your place in the family of things. Father, thank you for the Sabbath, for the chance to practice in our bodies our trust in you, our celebration of the things you've created and given us. Thank you for giving us to each other, and help our worship and our rest to refresh us for the work that we have to do in the world. In your name, amen.